I'm going to invite Tom, if you want to make your way up. Some of you probably recognize Tom if you've been around Lambert for a while. Tom Cowan was the pastor here for 23 years. I was just chatting with somebody, and they're like, Tom was a wonderful pastor. And so we were excited to have him here with us. Thanks, Tom, for being here with us today.
Thank you. It always gives me some strange memories when I walk into this place, and especially and come in. And a couple of years ago, I came into the office, which is all rearranged from when I was here, and I wanted something, but the person behind the office desk, I didn't know. So I said to them, "Hi, who are you?" And she said, "Who are you?" Scott invited me to do two Sundays when he's away, and I said I'd be delighted to do that. So with Harriet, we really enjoy coming back. Several Sundays ago, I'll tell you honestly, I was worshiping with you just sitting up there, and Simon commented that between 10 o'clock and 10:15, the congregation kind of doubles. Some years ago, when we were involved, we did two morning services, 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And so some guy in the foyer one morning said to me, "When does your 9 o'clock service start?" I really believe that punctuality should have been included in the fruit of the Spirit. You know, love, joy, peace, love, joy, punctuality. Anyway, I'll tell you honestly, Harriet and I are delighted that Scott is here as your pastor. We have known Scott and the whole Anderson clan for many, many years. And we sense that since his coming, he has brought a lot of stability to the church through his teaching ministry and through his very genuine pastoral spirit. And we say that very honestly this morning to you. And so my word to you is, take good care of him, okay? You've been working through Exodus, and it's a great book. Obviously, the story of Moses, the greatest escape story ever written, the truth of the Decalogue, that's the Ten Commandments, the covenant of God, and many of the great themes in Christianity that weave all through the scriptures are started in Exodus. So Scott gave me the chapters that I was assigned to work on for this week and next, and I thought several months ago, no problem. So a couple of weeks ago, I started to work on chapter 32, which is what I'm assigned for this morning, and I stood back and I thought to myself, I wonder if I can email Scott and get another chapter for the day. And he also told me that he'd not prepared any study guide or questions for you, so he said, some of the folks may not have read chapter 32. And so to make sense of what we're going to do this morning, we're going to have to sort of give a very brief summary of that and sort of, you know, what chapter 32 is really kind of all about. So I'm going to give you a very quick overview of the chapter to bring things into focus for all of us. We'll move quickly through this bit, in fact, through all of it. So really kind of fasten your seatbelts. Is that okay? You would think that following the escape from Egypt, meeting the truth of God and hearing the word of the covenant and the Ten Commandments, as we call them, the people would have remained for a long time on some kind of spiritual high with all that they'd gone through. Instead, when we turn it to chapter 32, we find them struggling with the fact that Moses has gone up to meet with God and he hasn't returned. So like, what happened to him? Where'd he go? He's our leader. So as chapter 32 opens, we find that Aaron is in command of the people. And the people start to clamor for a God. Now think about what they were told just before. No other gods. Now we want a God. And so they start to bring their jewelry and gold and earrings and stuff and melt it down in the form of an idol. And Aaron told them, take off the gold earrings that your wives and sons and daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings, handed them to him, and they made an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. They've forgotten. It was the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob who brought them out of Egypt. Now it's this calf. Remember, the one commandment was made. Do not make any graven image of God. They've forgotten it. It's exactly what they've done. And other nations, by the way, also use the image of a calf. And so in verse 7, the Lord says to Moses, go down to your people. Up to this time in Egypt, in Exodus, God has always called Israel my people. Now they're your people. Ever come home some night and your spouse says to you, would you go and talk to your children? You know, at that moment they're not hers, or, you know. So later in the chapter, Moses, as he comes down, says to Aaron, what happened? What happened? And then you get a series of classic human nature excuses. Well, you know how prone the people are to evil. Or another verse, I was only doing what the people wanted. You know, we took a vote, that's democracy, the majority won, that's what we did. Or the classic, we threw all the jewelry into the fire and out jumped the calf. Imagine. But in fashioning this calf, Israel is fashioning a new false religion. It's going against this monotheistic one God covenant that they were to follow. And so Moses hears the sound of singing and dancing. He throws down the tablets of the law. He's not losing his temper. He's not having a bad day. The idea is that the covenant that they'd made with God is now broken. He burns the golden calf, grinds it into powder, mixes it with water, makes them drink it. And the next major movement in the chapter is that Moses wants to go and seek God's forgiveness. And he will be the mediator. He will make atonement for the people. The chapter ends with some 3,000 people being put to death. The Lord replied to Moses, whoever sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Go and lead the people to the place I spoke of. My angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish them, I will punish them for their sin. And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they had done with the calf that Aaron had made. Reminds us that sometimes we take sin so lightly. It's no big deal. Wonder if we really understand that. So my question for the last couple of weeks to myself was, what do we make of this chapter today? It's not easy. How do we bring its message across our day and culture? What is a takeaway message for us this morning at Lambrecht Park Church in Victoria? And I often have said to you, it leaves so much behind. But let me invite you to stretch your minds and use your imagination with me this morning. Here's a question. Have we created a golden calf in our time that our culture calls us to worship instead of the transcendent God? That is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus. Have we created a calf for our day? Let me give you several examples of what might represent the gods of our culture and how we might have shaped them with the tools of our mind into thinking, and as a result, we've moved away from God. Some ideas. Some of this you may know and see today. We'll use some illustrations. I think of the God of secularism. The worldview that denies the spiritual. It roots us only in the here and now. Secularism has no long-term view of life. And so the secular is all that we have. In secular thinking, there is no place for anything that is spiritual, anything that is to do with God, and anything that is sacred is removed. There's no room and no time for the sacred in our lives. Secularism loses touch with what is transcendent and eventually loses a reference point from which to judge and evaluate everything. We see this secularism in Canada today. So I pulled some stuff out of the news in the last month or two. Actually, longer than that. Do you know that the BC legislature down here, the harbor, used to invite a pastor every day to open the day's proceedings of the government with prayer? Did you know that? I participated in that sometimes. You get a call from the speaker's office. Are you free and would you like to come down next Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever, and open Parliament with prayer? That stopped some years ago. I don't know why. I don't know who decided that. Do you know that election time, a Bible used to be placed across the top of the slot when people voted? We don't do that anymore. One of the issues in Quebec today is that secularism is being proposed as a law. Bill 21 proposes that anyone in a position of authority or giving service cannot wear symbols of religious conviction. In fact, the National Assembly has also voted unanimously to remove a large crucifix which is beside the Speaker's chair once Bill 21 is accepted and approved. Each Christmas here in Victoria, I think there's always some kind of protest against singing and playing Christmas carols in public down, for example, on the legislature grounds. All of that and so much more is the pressure of secularism in our society. In Saanich, the municipality where we live, there is a challenge rising to the public, to the tax-exempt status that religious buildings will receive through a public benefits test. And one of the issues in the public benefits test for churches is to be the issue in the question of inclusivity. One counselor says, if your organization is not inclusive, I am going to have a tough time supporting you for our tax-exempt status in religious buildings. One Catholic writer calls this the naked public square. It means when our public world is stripped of the influence of the sacred. You understand with me that the more our culture presses towards secularism as our God, it will force those with a spiritual agenda and a mission towards what is called privatization. In other words, we will be free to sing our hymns and practice our faith and reinforce our beliefs as long as we do that in the sphere of what is personal and private and within the walls of our church buildings. Our public voice is slowly being silenced. Perhaps over lunch today, you can talk about where do we see the force of secularism in British Columbia and in Victoria today? And what is it doing to Christianity and to our church? And the better question is, how should we respond? Think about it. Another sacred calf that we've built comes out of universities, but it's in our world today, is pluralism, and its cousin called relativism. So in pluralism, you see, there's no truth with a capital T. There's lots of small truths, and they're all equal. So everything is true. In pluralism, no one thought or ideology is allowed to stand above or against the others. Canada is officially pluralistic. The key word in Canadian society in which we like everything to be nice and polite is the word tolerance. G.K. Chesterton said, tolerance is the virtue of those who don't believe anything. Today, the only absolute is really whatever is relative. But when God said, you will have no other gods before me, that was not tolerant. There's no room for pluralism in that. Loving God with heart and soul and mind and strength calls for single-mindedness. In our culture, it seems to me that we've all but lost the battle for sexuality. We've lost it on the grounds of relativism and tolerance. So Christian parents, some of you here, who have kids in BC public schools, you have to decide what to do with the SOGI curriculum. And churches, I believe, must equip Christians and especially Christian parents about how to frame their thinking and their language in regard to sexuality in the public system. The alternative is an unhealthy extremism on both sides. You would have seen in Taiwan this past week that same-sex marriages were legalized. My great fear in the years I've been a pastor is that it seems to me that we've almost lost the battle for sacred sexuality in the church. I say that with fear and with trembling. I often think, what is there left to identify and distinguish those who have been to the mountain and who have heard and who hold the sacred truth which is holy and transcendent? What is there in our day to distinguish us? And may we continue to hold to the practice of marriage as a covenant union between a man and a woman. And as followers of Jesus, we express our sexuality in this sacred covenant union. And I know that following the way of Jesus will be costly for many, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual, single or married, young or old. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a pastor in Germany as the Second World War started, and who was eventually one day arrested and put in a concentration camp in Flossenbürg, where he hanged and died. Bonhoeffer wrote in one of his books, it's called The Cost of Discipleship. He says, when Jesus bids a man, he means a person, by the way, when Jesus bids a person come and die, come and follow him, he bids him come and die. And I challenge you that maybe one of the costly ways that we have to make that is the costly decision in our lives to be baptized. That really means that there's one way we will follow. I know you have a baptism service coming up next week. If you're a Christian, a follower of Jesus, you ought to be baptized. Now, that doesn't mean if you're not baptized, you're not a Christian. Didn't say that. But if you are a Christian, you ought to be baptized as you follow Jesus. Think seriously about that. Another one is pragmatism. The most important question used to be, is it true? Now the better question is, will it work? Not even the truth, but will it work? And the final question is, how much money will it make? That's the golden calf of consumerism in our day. Technique has triumphed over theology. And one day Jim Houston in Regent College wrote in a book, he says, technique has become the Trojan horse in the city of God. The real conflict between Christianity and pragmatism is the conflict between what is right and true and what is simply expedient, what simply will work. The Holocaust was a pragmatic solution to the Jewish question. Eichmann called it the final solution. It simply got the job done in the most efficient way. It was pragmatic both in its decision and in its execution. The issues of truth and conscience, morality, and the value of human life bearing the image of God were all ignored. It's pragmatic. Some years ago, I was privileged to be in Jerusalem on one of several visits. The most sobering place I have ever been in my life is what is called Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem is Hebrew for the heroes. And just outside Jerusalem on a green hilltop, it is a memorial to the Holocaust. And there over this acreage, you'll find railway cars and pictures, images of the barracks where people stayed. There's a synagogue which is dedicated to the children. And at the entrance to the synagogue, there's this huge pile of little shoes. I couldn't go in. I stood there and I cried. I still cry when I think about Yad Vashem. A pragmatic solution. In the trial of Jesus, he faced pragmatism. He was brought before Caiaphas, and Caiaphas didn't ask Jesus, was he innocent or guilty? Not interested in that. He didn't ask him whether his actions were right or wrong. Couldn't be bothered with that. He was not interested in those moral questions. He simply states, it is expedient for one die for the good of the nation. We need somebody to die this weekend. It looks like you're it. When we are reduced to merely what works, we have left truth on the mountainside. We have danced and shouted with the majority. It demands courage. It demands conscience to hear the voice of truth and obey it. That's what we're singing about this morning, that song. In his book, The Call, Oz Guinness, a British philosopher, talks about living before what he calls the audience of one. He means living before this transcendent God who is truth. Strong people think for themselves. They create their own moral culture. They are not afraid to stand and live before the audience of one, whether it pleases the majority or not. Strong people have been to the mountain. Strong people have heard the voice of the Holy God, and they have said, "We will obey." When I was preparing for this Sunday, I went back through some of an old series of notes on Exodus, found an old sermon. And I read what I'd written 15, 16 years ago for this congregation. It was, out of that sermon, a challenge to the younger generation. And I said then, and it's still true, it takes spiritual fortitude and moral guts for young people and young adults to maintain a high moral sexual lifestyle in the times in which we live. And I'll say to you, you are not the first generation to have struggled with temptation, not at all. A while ago, Harry and I were watching a CBC documentary addressing the subject of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. We watch all kinds of strange things. And it asked, what age group has the highest percentage of STDs in it? And the answer was not young people in high school. It was not young adults who are involved in casual relationships before their marriage. You know what it said? It said, it's those who are over 60 and up, who are often living in retirement homes, having lost a spouse, now single, and are not seeing any need to use sexual protection at their age. You got that? Now there's a takeaway from this morning. What did Tom say this morning? Oh, you don't want to know. So this golden calf, like the snake with many heads, has other heads. Hedonism, which is the pursuit of pleasure in our day. Consumerism, the pursuit of wealth. Positivism, which is positive thinking, which is now prized much more than reflection, meditation. Someone says athleticism is the new form of asceticism. You might have to think about that. Athleticism is the new form of asceticism. You listen well. Listen carefully for the next few minutes as we bring this to a close. It is always the responsibility of the people of God in any time and in every time in the culture in which they live to live like the people of God. Nothing less than that. Remember back in Exodus chapter 24, Moses took the book of the covenant and read it to the people, and they responded and they said, like the song we sung this morning, I think we're going to sing it again, everything the Lord has said, we will do. So Moses wrote the words of the covenant on tablets. Now, let's be honest. In its history in the Old Testament, Israel didn't always follow God. Sometimes it did. Sometimes it didn't. It often reflected if they're good kings, they followed God, and if they're really bad kings, they didn't follow God. Their life's like a spiritual roller coaster, up and down and up and down. And so there's one period in history, like many others, they didn't follow God. They lost sight of God. They'd forgotten his word. Nobody had read it for I don't know how long. And the reason was they had lost the book of the law. They'd lost this spiritual handbook. No one knew where it was. They hadn't seen it for a long time. They didn't know what it said. In the opening of the book of Samuel, it says, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. It's exactly what it is. I think that's the way it's like today. One morning here, a lady came forward at the end of a service. Her face was just beaming. I remember it. And she was so excited, and she was saying, I've got it. I've got it. I finally got it. So I thought, this will be interesting. So she came forward and said, can I talk to you? She says, this book you keep talking about, the Bible book. I said, yeah. She said, I figured out this morning, it's got two parts. Old part and a new part. She says, how do I go and buy the part that Jesus is in? That tells me about Jesus. And she was dead serious. Give her some direction. So one day in the history of Israel, a young king came to the throne. His name was Josiah. He was only 8 years old. And he gave money for an offering so that the temple, which was in disarray, the temple could be repaired. And in doing this repair work, you'll never guess, the workman found a copy of the book of the law. You find this in 2 Kings. It had been lost. That's why nobody knew it. That's why nobody read it. It got lost in the rubbish of all of this of the temple. It hadn't been read. The words hadn't been obeyed. So Josiah has it unearthed. Probably blows the dust off it. And then reads it. And it turns the people back to walking in the ways of God again. Then the king called together the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. He went up to the temple with the people of Judah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, priests and the prophets, all of the people from the least to the greatest. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant, which had been found in the temple of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar, renewed the covenant in the presence of the Lord, to follow the Lord, to keep his commandments and statutes and decrees with all their heart, with all their soul, confirming the words of the covenant written in this book. And all of the people pledged themselves to the covenant. Don't miss the point of that. The book of the law had been lost in the temple. And it was in the temple of God that it was found again. And so may I ask you as we close, have we lost the word of truth in the church? Have we moved from exposition to entertainment? And if so, do we need to rediscover the word of the Lord in the church, in our lives? What if we were to do just that? Rediscover the word of God, the word of the covenant, and renew the words of the covenant and say, this is the kind of people we will be in our culture. No matter what, this is who we will be. This is how we will live for our city, for our province, and for our time. May I invite you to stand? So as you stand, may I read for you again the heart and the core of the words of the covenant. And think quietly to yourself, I will do that. That's the kind of person I will be. So God says to you, God says to me, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. out of a life of slavery. There'll be no other gods, only me. No carved gods of any size, shape, form, or anything else, whether they fly, walk, or swim. Don't bow to them. Don't serve them. No using the name of the Lord your God in curses or silly banter. God won't put up with that. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Work 6 days and do all you need. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. It's the rhythm of work and rest. Work and rest. Honor your father and mother so you'll live a long life in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. No murder. No adultery. No stealing. No lies about your neighbor. No lusting after your neighbor's stuff. House, wife, servant, maid, ox, donkey, anything. Jesus gathered it all up and said, you will love the Lord your God with all of your heart. You will love the Lord your God with all of your most soul. And you will love the Lord your God with all of your mind. And all the people said,